Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Well, we need to be looking all over the world for where the opportunities are. Obviously, China's a big market, but it's not the only market. There's a lot of other growing Asian markets that we need to work at, trying to reduce some of their market-distorting tariffs and things like that, as well as Europe and other parts of the world. So Europe's always been a challenge for us as well.
Where does the U.S. need to focus when it comes to trade? That's former U.S. Ambassador to China and Iowa Governor Terry Branstad.
Look out. We need to put America first. We need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to open markets and knock down barriers to our agriculture products anywhere and everywhere in the world.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think supplemental feeding is going to be tough, especially when you consider we're very much looking at a record high price outlook for alfalfa and other hay. And so that probably isn't going to be a viable option to many of them if they don't have hay already in hand.
That's Caitlin McCullough, director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but this year's U.S. pasture and range conditions are worse than they were last year, which is maybe tough to believe and disheartening. But it has moved around a little bit, much more centered on the southern plains, Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, probably quite a bit in your area as well. Just excessive dryness over that. And mostly the impact so far, we haven't seen a ton of lightweight placements and feedlots yet, but I think that's probably coming. Mostly we've seen it on the cow side. And just an extreme number of cows being liquidated. I believe your region was up 30% year-to-date over a year ago in terms of volume of beef cow slaughter. So those are big numbers we're talking about. And that's actually boosted our total beef production by the sheer number of cows that are moving through the slaughter. And so from a perspective of what does that do to the calf crop, what are we looking at on July 1 or January 1? You know, you're probably looking at a pretty big decline at this point. Now, we're saying over 2%. I don't quite know what that means yet. I keep watching the weekly numbers. But essentially, hay isn't going to get any cheaper. And unless you get timely rains, pasture and range conditions are in a pretty dire situation already. And we're not even to June yet. We're not even through the hottest part of the year. The La Nina forecast still very much part of the picture and a little worrisome. So, unfortunately, it's a fairly bleak outlook. Now, USDA does rank conditions. They ask people, you know, is it poor or very poor conditions, which means you're absolutely having to provide some other feed for those animals. And we are looking at about 50% of total U.S. pasture and range, but if you look down to the southern plains, you know, it's closer to 60. Mm-hmm. So 60% of the area or of the pastures are requiring farmers or producers to provide something other than what's growing up.
What about the future of inventories?
It's a little bit of a double-edged sword. I mentioned that I thought, you know, feeder cattle prices might be moved lower just because so many of them might have to come be placed at the same time because of drought. But the flip side of that is that just means you're going to have even tighter supplies than we thought we were going to next year. And so what we've had to do is both adjust the near-term forecast down a little bit while we're increasing next year's. And so how high that goes next year might have more to do with weather again. It might have something to do with where we're at in terms of the U.S. economy, how much inflation is still a headwind, how much high beef prices matter. All those things are going to, what corn's doing, HALMIC has moved to a record high forecast, new record high for corn right now, has a 7 in front of it for a season average price. Those are all not good things. But I think that from the supply side of cattle, you are looking at all those things are going to press feeder cattle prices up. Right. And how much higher maybe is anybody's guess. LMIC is forecasting for the Southern Plains for 5 to 6 weights over the course of the whole year in 2023 is about a 4% increase from this year. But I think that could be, you know, 4 to 7% isn't out of the question. 4% might be on the low end. We've had to mess with this a little bit given where how high corn costs have been. But for a large part of 2022, I had a 2 in front of that number. So and you guys saw probably $2 calves earlier this year as well. And so for that to average over the whole year, it's a pretty strong calf market. On the feeder side, 7 to 8 weights, we have about a 7% increase in price in 2023 over 2022. But it looks like, at least for right now, that 2022 is going to be limited in upside to potential because of that cost of beef so high.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're going to see volatility in wheat for a while.
Donna Hughes is with StoneX.
Prior to the Ukrainian-Russian deal, I mean, we were basically, you know, hearing about production issues, you know, across the globe. And then with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and what they have done to basically shut off those ports, you know, in Ukraine, it's kind of exacerbated, you know, what we already knew. And as we're coming into harvest in the northern hemispheres, you know, we see countries like France downgrading their wheat conditions. We know what the situation is here in the U.S. And so, you know, we're looking to see, you know, where the excess might come from if we do have production shortages in the major exporters. India was one country that we were looking to globally to try to make up for some of that Ukrainian shortage. And, you know, unfortunately, they've had weather problems. And, you know, it came to the point where, you know, consideration for downgrading total volumes exported or, you know, shutting off exports. I mean, that's something that's been considered, you know, globally with many countries around the world, you know, as we get into what, you know, is looking to be like a, you know, a food crisis in regard to grains.
Weather is factoring in to acres.
With the rainfall and cooler temperatures that we had during most of this planting season, some of these areas, you know, have definitely experienced problems with getting the crop in or getting it in late in regard to corn. And, you know, so with that, you know, there's thought that we could either see more soybean acres or other alternatives as far as crops go. The other concern is that, you know, as the crop develops, specifically corn, you know, depending on what weather does, you know, over the growing season, those crops that went in late, if we get a lot of hot temperatures, hot, dry temperatures, that could affect yield greatly. And, you know, USDA's trend line that they're predicting for this year, you know, that's the question. If those conditions do occur, are we going to be able to meet that trend line on shortage of corn acres?
We're also seeing volatility in the equity markets.
You know, we've seen a lot of different type of action with the equities as of late. You know, for someone who follows equities versus commodities, you know, a lot of times there's transition in investments when people are funneling out of equities. They may funnel into the what they term alternative investments, such as commodities or other products. And we were seeing a good deal of that going on for a while, but it seems like, you know, things have kind of evened out in that way. And equities still remain volatile. You know, we've hit some levels that we haven't seen for a while on the low side. You know, inflation is here. The FOMC still has some things that they're going to be doing down the road with interest rates. That's something that producers are very concerned about, obviously, with, you know, capital investments and loans and all.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, I think this is the first time ever we've had gas over $4 a gallon in every single state in the country. It's never happened before.
It's Kansas State farm management economist Greg Ibendahl.
Now, if you go back and readjust the numbers and put them in real dollar terms, and yeah, there have been some periods of pretty high gas prices. But I think what has caught people a lot by surprise is how quickly fuel prices have actually increased. So if you go back to really to January 1st of 2021 over the past, you know, 18 months or so, really, gasoline prices have doubled and diesel prices have way more than doubled here. You know, and what has really, I think, got producers concerned is when you look at the relationship, not only is, you know, gas over $4 a gallon, but now we're looking at diesel prices over $1 a gallon when you look at highway price over what the gas price is. And that gap has really never existed before.
Some suggest this is due to the Ukrainian situation.
Yeah, I think we certainly blame, you know, some of it on the Russian-Ukraine conflict because, you know, oil was probably like $90 a barrel before that happened, but then it's, you know, it's in the 110 to 120 range now. But again, a big chunk of that actually occurred during 2021. So like in 21, looking at the oil price back then, it was in the upper 40s. And then, it, you know, that pretty much doubled over the course before the Russian-Ukraine conflict even started. I think what we had a situation coming out of the COVID where there was pretty strong demand. The economy was proving pretty quickly. And we had strong demand for fuel. So fuel prices just took off in 2021. And again, they had more than doubled. But then when the Ukraine conflict happened, we saw a big increase in fuel prices again. So, you know, you can blame the Russian-Ukraine for a chunk of it. But again, probably more than half of it occurred really before that.
And then when we look at the gas to diesel spread.
Well, I think there's several things going on there. So when the economy started picking up, if you look at the inventories of gasoline and diesel prices over the last year and a half, they have gone way down. Gas has gone down to some degree, although they've kept up the gas supply kind of to what it historically has been, although it's still below average to some degree. But diesel fuel has really been drawn down. We're looking at diesel inventories right now that are at least a third below over what they historically have been. And that really has caused a big discrepancy we're seeing in prices. There's such a demand for diesel. There's such low inventory supplies that has really pushed the price of diesel up. So really, refiners right now have every incentive they can to make as much diesel as they can. Remember, you can only make, you know, so much diesel from a barrel of oil, so the refiners have some ability to, you know, adjust that mixture of gas and diesel. And in fact, if you look at what the Energy Information Association says, they don't really know exactly how much refiners can adjust that mix, but they can adjust it some. And based on what the price difference is right now, I think you are going to see refiners kind of making more of a push to make more diesel as much as they can.
Maybe it comes down to capacity.
Well, it's really capacity and utilization. So what was really compounding things this spring was refineries do a lot of their maintenance in the period from February through April. So they had a lot of capacity shut down during that time frame to do the normal maintenance, yearly maintenance. So we weren't producing as much fuel as we could have during that time frame. But if you look at capacity, that has actually dropped quite a bit. So right before the pandemic happened, we've lost really about 5% during that time frame. So obviously they shut down a lot of capacity during the whole COVID thing because there just wasn't the demand. But that capacity hasn't bounced back. We're still about 5% below where we should be as far as what capacity was before the pandemic happened. Utilization, looking at what percent of the refineries are being utilized. So we're probably in the 90% range right now. But historically, that has been higher. It has been up to close to 95%. And the EIA is actually predicting we're going to be probably 95 or above this summer. But again, it's going to take a little bit to ramp up from that downtime they had during their maintenance in early spring. But that should ramp back up during the summer and will be more historically utilization percent. But again, we're still below capacity where we should be.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, personal relationships are really important, especially in the Asian cultures.
Former Iowa governor and former ambassador to China, Terry Branstad.
One of the advantages I had was I was the first American governor to host Xi Jinping when he was just a county-level party secretary, and he led an ag delegation to Iowa in 1985. And I had been to China in 84, and we'd been treated very well there, so we wanted to go all out to treat him well. And so he calls me and the Iowans he met in 1984 old friends. So building that kind of relationship is really important. And, of course, the Meat Export Federation and many agriculture work groups have worked for decades to build personal relationships. That is critically important, and especially been challenging now as we've gone through this COVID epidemic over the last two or two and a half years. But we need to hopefully get past that and continue those relationships.
Again, the former ambassador to China on differences in China now with COVID.
Unfortunately, China has a different approach. You know, they have a zero tolerance policy in a city like, let's say a city like Beijing, over 20 million people, 6 cases, they lock down the whole city and they test people every day or every other day. And so the hotels are closed, the restaurants, you only can get takeout. And so it's a very difficult situation. And I think it's created a real hardship and it's really hurt their economy as well. And it's also impacted the supply chain.
And it leads to supply chain disruptions.
Shanghai, I think, is the biggest port in the world. And when you have this kind of a heavy lockdown there, it does disrupt the supply chain and it hurts our trade.
One area that American producers have really excelled in is delivering pork to the Chinese market.
We benefited when they went through the African swine fever and they lost a lot of their pork herd. They had to rebuild it. And of course, the Chinese, their top choice of protein is pork. So we were able to export a lot of pork during that time. And now it's a little different situation. They actually are putting a pork into reserve in China because they have an excess amount right now. But I think it's all going to change. With the price of corn and soybeans being where it is, I'm sure that pork production in China will probably be reduced. And so I grew up on a farm. I've seen the ups and downs in the market over the years. And we need to be able to deal with both the ups and the downs.
But China has an affinity for Brazilian ag. Should that concern U.S. producers?
Brazil is in the southern hemisphere, and they are a major producer as well as us. They will always purchase from both of us, I think. But a lot will depend on the crops and the market and all of that sort of stuff. And so, we need to recognize Brazil is a competitor, but I think they need both of us. The other thing is Ukraine. You see, the Ukraine is a major grain producer, and that's been tremendously disrupted by the war. So they're trying to make up for that by purchasing from Brazil or wherever they can.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You're seeing between corn, soybeans, and wheat. Wheat has, over the last 1 or 2 weeks, has come down probably the most.
Dr. Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State grain economist.
Where it's come down from is pretty important. You've gotten up within the last 1.5, 2 weeks, gotten to highs about 1375. And we had been trading at highs of about 1260 or so until this recent run-up. Well, now we've ran up to what we talked about 1275, have come down now, closed yesterday at 1228, and are looking at where we just came from, 1475. But it wasn't that long ago where the 1228 that we're sitting at would have been near the top of the trading range. So that just shows the inflation in that market. So I think that there's been some weakness off of those extreme highs. Whatever we get for hard red winter wheat harvest is coming soon. So that you could argue that that will help, even though, you know, you could look at Texas, Oklahoma, parts of Kansas, but our Kansas wheat tour, we're down a little bit. You do see still issues up in the Dakotas and on into Canada, Minnesota, elsewhere, of just such excessive moisture that they're having a difficult time getting the spring wheat crop in. And we're talking about a difficult time. We're not just saying that they're 5, 10, or 15% slow. They're like 50 or 60% behind pace. So you've got issues like that. And we up there are approaching insurance dates. That's how tough the situation is. And, you know, you get that far north, you have hard freeze dates on the end if you start planting that stuff too late. So when the world would have really benefited from a large North American wheat crop, we're struggling with all these problems. Seems like soft red's doing well, but that's about the only one. It's been this ongoing conundrum for wheat in that with all that's going on in the world and the likelihood that we would hope to see pretty strong U.S. wheat exports, we just haven't seen it. And it just brings up the question of when other buyers might run out of other options and come to the U.S. shores. That's even exacerbated here of late. India, which was going to take advantage of the situation with what they thought were coming with a great crop, read where they've had such heat of late that instead of being an exporter, they're about down to break even and may even have to import a little bit. So you run into that type of situation in the world market. So I guess overall, the wheat situation, we've come down off of tremendous highs, are still very strongly supported by a very, very tight world market. And we'll continue to move forward. And I guess someday when the world runs out of other options and has to come buying wheat from the U.S., then we'll see where the markets go from there.
That's wheat, but what about corn and soybeans?
Price-wise, both of those futures, both the July futures markets for both of those are basically in sideways channels, and they bounce around within that. We had a great export week for corn and for grain sorghum for the week ending the May 19th, just so-so for soybeans. Planting progress, really pretty good, except in the Dakotas. So we're getting a crop planted. It's got, in a lot of places, got pretty good subsoil moisture. So one of the issues that's probably leading to some weakness in corn futures, Dease closed yesterday at 718, had been sharply higher than that. Again, more like 20, 30 cents higher than that here of late. So you're seeing some of that weakness. Even with all that, soybeans, gangbusters, you know, running to the high side. So go figure that. So we have great exports for corn, and the price is kind of sideways, a little bit lower. We have sideways to poor exports for soybeans. We're running strong. So just is as it is.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, we've been talking about this since the fall of last year when there were about $6 billion allocated for row crop producers for what they were calling at the time an extended WIP program.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Plains Cotton Growers.
That had to work its way through the process from the allocation all the way to the implementation. And so we have finally seen the results of that. First of all, this extended emergency relief program had a component for livestock. And so that component went out first. Once that was done, they moved over into the row crops. And that's where we're at today. It is a program that, from what we have seen thus far and heard about, it's very similar in fashion and in structure to the last WIP program. However, the name, as you mentioned, did change. And so producers will be getting information, if they haven't already, about the emergency relief program. And actually, we know that the mailouts for this program for pre-field applications went out on May the 24th. So today, I expect that many producers will see this ERP information in their mailboxes, and they'll need to take a look at all of this and check it out, and then they'll need to return that to their Farm Service Agency offices, and that has to be returned no later than July the 22nd. Of course, I'm sure that I know it's a busy time. I know everybody's in the field now. But I would just certainly encourage people as soon as they can to sit down and look through this information and not to wait until that deadline. Of course, if people have money coming to them, then I'm sure that they'll be anxious also to get this get this returned so that they can get this relief process started quickly. And so, again, July the 22nd is the deadline on that. From what we understand, this program, as I've already said, is very similar to WIP, but there are a few minor changes, and from what we've seen so far, all of the changes are to the good. In other words, tweaks and adjustments that will make the program more friendly toward producers. And one of those is the fact that where the last WIP application took several hours to be filled out by producers and coming up with the data, and then several more hours to be verified at the Farm Service Agency offices. Well, this one is utilizing RMA data. So it's going to pull that RMA data down, put it all together in a pre-filled application, and then that will be sent directly to those producers. And producers need to just get that, check out those numbers, and see how that compares to their numbers in terms of production for the years of 2020 and 21. And once they get that verified, then they'll need to send that back to the FSA. Also, if there are any questions, since this is using RMA data, then the producers will need to contact their insurance representatives so that they can get information directly through RMA. And so that's how we know that it's going to work. And we do expect, as people open those up and are looking into that this week, that we'll receive a lot of questions on it, and we look forward to being there to support and to help out producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Early this year, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack held a Capitol Hill hearing on competition in the meat processing industry.
We are going to come up with a very creative way to significantly expand processing capacity in this country.
And USDA has announced several more programs that could be doing just that, with a broader goal of
creating a stronger food supply chain, and particularly one that focuses on meat and poultry processing.
Dr. Karama Neal heads up USDA's Rural Business Cooperative Services. She says one of these newly announced programs is called the Meat and Poultry Intermediary Lending Program. Really, it's a $200 million competitive grant program in which USDA awards money to nonprofit lenders so they can create revolving loan funds.
They loan the funds out initially. Initially, they have to be loaned to a meat or poultry processor. But as those funds are repaid, they can still be loaned to a meat and poultry processor, but they can also be loaned across the food system.
USDA will be accepting program applications from nonprofit lenders until the end of July. There will be another application window this fall. Gary Crawford, Washington.